speaking about the Buddha, one could ask, how is the Buddha same or different from us? What did the Buddha want? And basically, what the Buddha wanted was to be happy. But he didn't want to be happy in such a way where the happiness would be there for a few minutes or a few hours or a few days and then would leave. But he wanted the type of happiness that would be permanent and stable. And Buddha couldn't find that anywhere in the manifest world where everything is constantly changing. He saw that people enjoyed food and they were eating the food, and while they were eating the food, it tasted very, very good. But unfortunately, what happened was the meal at a certain point was over, the food was swallowed, and that delicious taste in the mouth was gone. And then what happened was people went on to try to fill their desire for contentment and happiness with everything that they could see, everything that they can taste, everything they can smell, touch. Through all the five senses, they were trying to maintain some contentment, some happiness. But Buddha noticed that through any of the five senses, people were not able to maintain a stable state of peace and contentment and happiness. And he found that situation to be unacceptable. Everyone knows the story about Buddha, I think, that he was born as a prince to Suddhodana and Mahadevi, were his parents. And he had everything that a prince could want, and his good father tried to save him from seeing anything of a negative nature in the world. But one day Buddha decided to go out on a field trip with a chariot driver. And he started to look around, and even though the king tried very hard to make sure that nothing was in his sight that would upset him, it turned out that he saw someone that was sick, he saw someone that was old, he saw someone that was in the process of dying, and he saw someone who was being carried away to be cremated. And he realized very, very clearly that what happened to these people were also going to happen to me. And he became very frightened. Just became frightened. He didn't want to get sick. He didn't want to grow old. He didn't want to die. And he wanted to find, if at all possible, a life that was non-ending and unconditioned by anything of the relative world. He didn't want his contentment or peace or happiness to be temporary. He didn't want his contentment, peace, or happiness to be limited in any way whatsoever, either by time or by space. And that's what drove him to join a band of ascetics, monks, to leave his wife and to leave his young child, to leave his mother and father and all the princely accoutrements that he had, and went out into the forest and joined a group of people that were very, very serious about leaving behind the temporary finite world. And he joined this group for about 6 or 7 years. And they practice very intense austerities. They starve themselves practically to death. They expose their bodies to intense heat for many, many hours, intense cold for many, many hours, deprive themselves of sleep night after night. And Buddha did this with them for about 6-7 years. And he was going through a lot of suffering and wasn't finding the permanent peace and contentment that he was desiring. And he wasn't finding the escape from suffering that he was desiring. As a matter of fact, the type of life that he was living was increasing his suffering. And he figured, you know, something's got to be wrong here. And being a wise man, he said, you know, maybe we're going about it the wrong way. Maybe it's okay to have some food at least once a day. Maybe it's okay that when it gets really, really hot, I don't have to force myself to stay out in the sun hour after hour after hour, or force myself to stay in the pouring rain, or never give myself sleep. Maybe after 6 or 7 years, I have to try something different. Because what I've been doing has not really been successful. So what Buddha discovered was the famous middle way, where a person didn't overindulge in the senses, but at the same time, they also did not overindulge in depriving the senses or depriving the body of necessary food. So he discovered a way that was not too austere, but at the same time, still a very disciplined life. And he was meditating, and he sat down under this famous tree, as we see in the picture here. What Buddha was trying to do was to somehow transcend these kinds of experiences that all of us have pretty much every day. And he sat under this famous banyan tree and went into a very deep meditation. And he was tested in many, many different ways by all kinds of offers from the deceiver. And in Buddhism, the deceiver is called Mara. Mara. And the deceiver was trying very hard to get the Buddha away from the experience of that stable state of contentment and bliss. And he tried to offer him every possible thing, every possible sense pleasure, every possible physical pleasure, every possible mental and emotional pleasure, tremendous amount of wealth, anything that one could think of that could possibly provide happiness in the time-space-bound manifest relative world was offered to Buddha. And Buddha knew already, he knew that this was not going to give him the permanent state of contentment that he wanted. So he rejected all of those gifts. And Mara, the deceiver, sometimes they call him the evil one, it's a great reputation, decided, okay, I'm giving up. This person is serious. He really wants to gain that state of nirvana. In the scriptures, Buddha summarized it like this. When I was a young man, at the beginning of my life, I looked at nature and saw that all things are subject to decay and death, and thus to sorrow. The thought came to me that I myself was of such a nature. I was the same as all created things. I too would be subject to disease, decay, death, and sorrow. But what if I were to search for that which underlies all becoming? For the unsurpassed perfect security, which is nirvana, the perfect freedom of the unconditioned state. The reality came to me is profound and hard to see or understand because it is beyond the sphere of thinking. He found that transcendental level of life, that pure being, the source of everything, and he knew it to be beyond the sphere of conceptualization, beyond the sphere of the mind and the intellect. He says it is sublime and unequaled, but subtle and only to be found by the dedicated. He said most people fail to see this reality, for they are attached to what they cling to pleasures and delights. Since all the world is so attached to material things, it's very difficult for people to grasp how everything originates in conditions and causes. Everything is dependent upon everything else. And in order to have any situation, you need A for B and B for C and C for D. And everything is changing and interacting and moving around. And there is no security there. But people can't see beyond that. They accept the life where sometimes they'll feel safe and sometimes they won't feel safe. Sometimes they'll be at peace and sometimes they won't be at peace. They accept that. And Buddha's saying it's very difficult for them to see beyond that aspect of life. He says it's a hard job for them to see the meaning of the fact that everything, including ourselves, depends on everything else and has no permanent self-existence. If I were to teach this truth, this reality, nobody would understand me. My labor and my trouble would be for nothing. So he was going to not do any teaching at all. He was just going to sit in that state of nirvana, that blissful, unconditioned state, and leave the world to the world. Because he felt there was nothing that he could do. But then it came to him, an insight came to him. He said that, you know, I should teach this truth, for it is also happiness. There are people whose sight is only a little clouded, and they are suffering through not hearing the reality. They would become knowers of the truth. It was in this way that I went forth to teach. It reminds me of how Maharishi said that even if one person in 100 hears the message, then it was a good use of time to go and speak to those 100 people, even if just one heard. And Buddha knew, he knew intuitively, that there were some people who would be able to hear about that which is beyond the sensorial level, beyond the mental, intellectual, and emotional level, and be able to achieve a state of stability that exists beyond the changing values of all time and space. And he said, for those who are ready, the door to the deathless state is open. You that have ears, give up the conditions that bind you and enter in. The Buddha was a very, very dynamic figure, extremely dynamic figure. People would just look at him and just say, teach me. I don't care what you teach me, but just teach me. Because he had a glow about him, a confidence about him, a deep security about him, a fearlessness about him, doubtlessness, no worry, no anxiety, no fear. He just lived in the moment in peace because of his achievement of that unconditioned state of nirvana. So people were drawn to him. And he taught many people over approximately 50 years in various parts of India. And many people gained enlightenment because of Buddha. And Maharishi said some things about Buddha that I would like to share with you. These are some quotes from Maharishi from his commentary on the first 6 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. And this is what Maharishi said about Lord Buddha. When the philosophy of the integrated life, integrating the absolute with the relative, restored by Lord Krishna, was lost from view, the idea grew that everything which life can offer is present on the obvious levels of existence, and that it would therefore be useless to aspire to anything that might lie deeper than external appearances. Society became dominated by this superficial outlook. Insight into reality was lost, the sense of right values forgotten, and the stability of life destroyed. Tension, confusion, superstition, unhappiness, and fear prevailed. Lord Buddha came to remedy the situation. Finding the field of action distorted, he came with a message of right action. And speaking from his level of consciousness established in being, in eternal freedom, nirvana, Lord Buddha taught the philosophy of action in freedom. He advocated meditation in order to purify the field of thought through direct contact with being and bring the state of right action in society. Lord Buddha's message was complete because he incorporated the fields of being, thinking, and doing in his theme of revival. But because his followers failed to correlate these different fields of life in a systematic manner through the practice of transcendental meditation, and when Maharishi's using the word transcendental meditation here, he knows that in those days it was not called transcendental meditation, but he was talking about a transcending process where the mind went beyond all the boundaries of both gross and subtle manifest creation, transcended even the subtlest level of manifest creation, and had a direct experience of the unconditioned state, the state of nirvana. That process of transcending he's referring to as what we commonly know today as transcendental meditation. They fail to correlate these different fields of life in a systematic manner through transcending, and realization of being as the basis of a good life became obscured. The whole structure of Buddha's teaching not only became distorted, but it was turned upside down. And I'll show you as we go on in the course how his teaching about meditation was literally turned upside down, and how his descriptions of the enlightened state were also turned upside down, and how what people tried to do to gain enlightenment after the Buddha was misinterpreted. Through that misinterpretation, the application of Buddha's teachings became extremely distorted. And we'll explore that as we go forward. Maharishi puts it this way. He said, the effect was mistaken for the cause. Right action came to be regarded as the means to gain nirvana, whereas right action is in fact the result of this consciousness in freedom. It has been the misfortune of every teacher that while he speaks from his level of consciousness, his followers can only receive his message on their own level, and the gulf between the teaching and understanding grows wider with time. The teaching of right action without due emphasis on the primary necessity of realization of being is like building a wall without a foundation. It sways in the wind and collapses before long. Within 300 or 400 years, all real connection between the essential teachings of Lord Buddha and the daily life of his followers had disappeared. Insight into the principle of the integrated life was again lost. Having forgotten the prime importance of realizing being, society became immersed once more in the superficialities of life. I just want to share with you something from this really excellent book by one of the great, very great scholars of Buddhism, who himself became Buddhist. His name was Edward Cones. It's a book called Buddhism, Its Essence and Development. And I just want to share a short passage of that. He's speaking about the decline of the knowledge of the Buddha's Dharma, the Buddha's teaching, about how to gain the state of full awakening. Now, the old wisdom school is that school which had the most direct historical connection to Lord Buddha, to Siddhartha. By the way, you know, Siddhartha was his name, his first name, and Siddhartha means one who will achieve his desire, one who will achieve his goal. And the Buddha's last name, his family name, was Gotama. And the meaning of Gotama means excellent ox. And if you had excellent ox, and if you had an excellent ox in those days, you were doing very well. So to be called an excellent ox was a very high compliment. So Siddhartha Gautama, and he belonged to a group of that was called the Shakyas. The branch of his family were called the Shakyas. So Siddhartha Gautama was known as Shakyamuni, the wise one of the Shakyas, the tribe of the Shakyas.
So it says here,
the very methods which the old wisdom school had advocated about 300 years after the Buddha's nirvana, meaning after the Buddha's passing, the teaching began to lose much of its efficacy. In the beginning of the order, we hear of many who became arhats. Arhats means perfected beings, people who achieved the fully awakened state, achieved the state of enlightenment. Some of them with astonishing ease. As time went on, however, fewer and fewer cases are recorded in later writings. In the end, as shown by the prophecies in some of the Buddhist scriptures, the conviction spread that the time for arhats was over. The cream had been taken off the milk. The scholars ousted the saints, and erudition, scholarly learning, took the place of direct attainment of enlightenment.